Glad that you're all here, and Pastor Steve, we're excited to have you open the Word with us at the end of the day. Let's greet Pastor Steve as he comes to share.
Good morning, and it is really good to be with all of you. And some of you have commented that I've been moving kind of slow this morning and a little sore, but I want you to know that I am feeling the best I have felt in probably 12 years. Nice. That yesterday was a long time in coming.
You won.
Yeah, and I am just so grateful that Michael DeBoof is off this district now. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this good day. Thank you for your love and your mercy upon us and for waking us up again in your grace. And we pray that as we give our attention to your word, that you would speak afresh to us, open our ears to hear you, our hearts to receive you, our minds that we might be obedient to you. Have your way in our midst, we pray. Amen. Okay, so today is kind of a, I don't know, moving day, transition day. So we're going to go from that first section of Isaiah 1 to 39, which the primary theme is judgment, and the dominant empire is Assyria, to now we're going to go to the middle section of Isaiah where the dominant empire is and the theme is restoration. And so we're kind of make that jump today from 39 to 40. And so let's just go ahead and jump in at 39. And so turn to Isaiah 39. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift because he had heard of his illness and recovery. Hezekiah received the envoys gladly and showed them what was in his storehouses, the silver, the gold, the spices, the fine oil, his entire armory, and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in his palace or in all his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and asked, "What did those men say and where did they come from?" "From a distant land," Hezekiah replied. "They came to me from Babylon." The prophet asked, "What did they see in your palace?" "They saw everything in my palace," Hezekiah said. "There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord, and some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," Hezekiah replied, for he thought, "There will be peace and security in my lifetime." All right, go ahead, tell your neighbor what you think of Hezekiah.
He's such a wise and smart man.
Okay, so while on the one hand, the big theme of chapters 1 to 39 is judgment, the big message that Isaiah has been trying to call king after king to is to trust God. That everything depends upon trusting the Lord. And so he tried to get Ahaz to trust the Lord. And the Lord wants you to trust him. Just ask the Lord for a sign. And we saw that Ahaz did not want to take the risk of trusting, that Ahaz wanted to stay in control. And so he actually thought he could stay in control by trusting Assyria. And he reached out to Assyria and he made a deal with Assyria that cost him dearly, but that's how he wanted to play it, rather than trusting the Lord. And so Isaiah's message to him was, yes, the Lord is with us. The Lord is with you. But now you're going to experience the Lord with us through the Lord bringing Assyria against us. And it's going to be incredibly painful. you're going to learn that you should have trusted the Lord. Ahaz dies, Hezekiah, his son, comes to the throne, and Hezekiah has to deal with the mess that Ahaz left him. He's got to deal with Assyria. And we saw the other day, yesterday, all the oracles against the nations, and it's basically Isaiah trying to convince Hezekiah and all the leadership of Jerusalem, don't trust Babylon, don't trust Egypt, don't try to form a new coalition. What you need to do is trust the Lord. And so heavy emphasis that the call is to trust the Lord and that God is indeed trustworthy. And that God is with us, and when we don't trust God, it's not that somehow God abandons us. It's basically that God says, okay, you want to trust this instead of me? Let me teach you what that's like. And so they're under and experiencing kind of waves of judgment. Now, Hezekiah, to his credit, there are key moments where he trusts the Lord. He has advisors telling him to go down to Egypt and to make an alliance with Egypt, and maybe Egypt will help us get rid of Assyria. And he resists. And eventually, and you can read about this in chapters 36 and 37, that the Assyrians have Jerusalem surrounded. And what does Hezekiah do? He cries out to the Lord. And the Lord saves him. And he learned the value of trusting in the Lord, that the Lord is trustworthy. And then, being delivered, now he gets a word from the Lord, hey, get your house in order, you're going to die. And that's really a pretty special thing to know that you're going to die and to have the opportunity to actually get your house in order. And yet, his response is, like many of our responses would be, oh Lord, give me more time. And he cries out to God. He knows that the Lord is the giver of life, that life belongs to the Lord to give and to take. And so he trusts the Lord, and the Lord responds to him, and the Lord grants him 15 more years. Now, after this happens, this is when the Babylonians send their envoy to him. And roughly ballpark date, we don't know exactly. There are some different theories, but for our purposes, 700 years before Jesus. Okay, so we're about 700 years before Jesus, and still in Assyrian world, but Hezekiah and Jerusalem has experienced God's salvation from Assyria, and Hezekiah has experienced God's salvation from death. And so things are well. When do you serve the Lord best? When do you trust the Lord best? Do you trust the Lord best in hard times when you begin to realize that the Lord is your only option? Or do you trust the Lord best in times of blessing where everything is going well? Well, what we see with Hezekiah is that he does not trust the Lord very well in good times. And so this envoy comes and they're bringing gifts and he's not suspicious at all. And we're kind of wondering ourselves, okay, why would Babylon send gifts to Hezekiah? And so we're questioning their motivation. And then why is Hezekiah so excited to receive them and to receive the gifts? And did you notice what Hezekiah did? He showed them everything, right? Who's missing in his speech? He never mentions the Lord. He never talks about how the Lord blessed me with this, how the Lord delivered us from Assyria, how the Lord cured me. He does not give any ink whatsoever, no breath whatsoever, no praise to the Lord. And he's acting like at some level that this is all of his glory. And so the Babylonians come, and I want to pause for a moment and think about what their agenda might be. Their agenda at some level is to overtake Assyria. And it's going to take them some 90 years to actually overthrow Assyria from this time in Hezekiah's life. But that's their agenda. And so they probably really aren't, you know, hey, Hezekiah, we're so happy that God healed you. We want to give you a gift. They're giving him a gift. Why? To place him in their debt. Okay, it's kind of like when somebody pays you a compliment. Now what do you got to do? Yeah. Okay, and so they're sending him a gift, and so now all of a sudden it's kind of like he's in debt to them at some level, and they're probably trying to use him in their agenda to overthrow Assyria. And maybe they're thinking that if we can motivate Hezekiah at some level to further his rebellion against Assyria, he'll become a distraction to Assyria, and Assyria will be vulnerable on the east side where we can come and attack and take over. I mean, I don't know. I just don't question the motive, the agenda of the Babylonians to be sending a gift to King Hezekiah. You know, who's really kind of a nobody on the world map. So why are they gifting him? Okay, so I'm suspicious of the Babylonians. Okay, now what's going on with Hezekiah? Why is he showing them everything? Is he insecure? Is he trying to impress them with what a great king he is? I mean, look at all my wealth. I mean, that would be like me showing Donald Trump my bank account as if he would be impressed. Okay, it's that kind of a deal. Let me show you all my treasures. And they're coming from where? Babylon, where you have all the treasures of the world. So why is he trying to impress them as if he could impress them? Is he looking for validation from them? And so I just think that there's some type of insecurity here where he is looking for validation and he's trying to impress them and he gives no mention of the Lord.
Any thoughts on his age at this time?
I'd have to look that up. Old enough to know better. So... I don't know. Anybody know? I mean, you're welcome to Google it if you got Wi-Fi in here. Nobody's going to speak up and bail me out. So I'm just going to stick with old enough to know better.
That's a fair answer.
So, yeah, I'll research. So here we are, and Isaiah shows up to him, and what's Isaiah tell him? They're going to take everything you've shown them. Everything you've shown them, they will be back and they'll take it all. And they're going to take some of your sons, your grandsons, and they're going to make them eunuchs, and they're going to serve the king of Babylon. And you know, from a biblical standpoint, the worst thing about eunuchs in terms of I'm going to make your sons and grandsons eunuchs, the promise to David. Is like putting the promise to David in jeopardy. That you will never fail to have a son on the throne. And so, I don't know what's up with Hezekiah.
Good.
I don't know why he fell in such good times. But we see him make a disastrous decision where he becomes arrogant about himself and what God has blessed him with. Only he leaves out the part of God's blessing and tries to impress the world. And then he goes on to think that, well, at least there will be peace in my lifetime. Now, what kind of a king is that? And my question is, he cried out to God when Assyria had him and Jerusalem surrounded. And he cried out to God when he was mortally ill. And now he gets this word, and he doesn't cry out to God. He doesn't care about the next generation. It's just so sad. What happened to him? I don't know. But that's where 39 ends. And we have Isaiah announcing this word that the Babylonians are coming. And, you know, they're not going to come for some time, but they are coming. And so now we jump to chapter 40. And we have a whole new scenario. Comfort, comfort my people, says our God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, or her warfare has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. We have a whole new context, a Babylonian context. And so I don't know how much to try to unpack here, but basically, Hezekiah is going to die. You're going to have Manasseh. He's a terrible king. And then you're going to have Josiah. And under Josiah, Josiah begins a reform. And that's roughly around 640 is when Josiah becomes king. And the reform, I think they find the Book of the Covenant in the temple. You get dates for that, like around 622, right in that time period. At this point, Jeremiah is at work prophesying. And Josiah is working to bring about this reform to where all of worship is centralized in Jerusalem. And he's really trying to eliminate any of the kind of Canaanite worship practices that would have been incorporated in the worship of the Lord. And so he's really working on this reform. And Assyria is getting a little bit weaker, and Babylon is getting stronger. And 611, Babylon actually conquers Nineveh. Okay, Nineveh is the capital of Assyria. Now, Assyria is still strong. Babylon hasn't taken over the world yet, but they are getting much, much stronger. They are on the doorsteps of taking over the world. The people down in Egypt, they see Babylon coming. And they would rather stop Babylon up at Assyria than have to fight Babylon off in their own territory. And so the Pharaoh at that time, what he decides to do is he's going to take his troops and he's going to go up through Palestine, up through Judah, and join with Assyria to try to defeat Babylon. Okay, the Assyrians are getting weaker. Egypt doesn't want to have to mess with Babylon. Let's go help Assyria stop Babylon so that Babylon never makes it down to our soil. Okay, are you kind of tracking with me? Okay, so it would be kind of like Sacramento taking over the valley. And the people of Bakersfield going up to try to help Fresno stop Sacramento there so that they never make it all the way down to Bakersfield to take over. Okay, it's that kind of a thing where we don't want them on our doorsteps. We're going to send troops to try to stop it up here. Well, we think that this is what's going through Josiah's mind. That Josiah recognizes that Babylon is going to carry the day. And so what Josiah decides to do is he takes his troops out to try to stop Egypt from passing through Judah to go help Assyria. He's probably thinking that if I can do this, then Babylon will be indebted to me for stopping Egypt. Are you tracking? And so he's trying to place himself well with Babylon. And it's like, Babylon, I know you got Assyria. And if I can stop Egypt from going to help Assyria, it's kind of like you owe your victory to me because I saved you from Egypt. Okay, and so that's probably what's going through his mind. And what happens is, well, it's a foolish thing. He got killed. So he went out to stop the Egyptians, and the Egyptians killed him and came right on through. And so the Egyptians, there was one son of Josiah that went on the throne for about 3 months. And then the Egyptians put a guy on the throne, and his name is Jehoiakim. Okay, say that with me, Jehoiakim. Real important to get the ending of it, Kim. Yeah, the M ending. So Jehoiakim. So they placed him on the throne. And so now he is a vassal king. Okay, a vassal king is a king that owes his throne to an empire. And so he's got to pay taxes to Egypt in terms of being able to keep his throne to maintain his rule. And so Jehoiakim is a vassal king to the Egyptians. He's still son of David. He's still on the throne. Everything is functioning, but he's paying tribute to Egypt. Babylon comes through, and Babylon takes over. And so Jehoiakim, about 605, he has to switch his allegiance. He is no longer a vassal king of Egypt. He is now a vassal king under Babylon. And this is the first wave of exile. When the Babylonians come through, they leave Jehoiakim on the throne, but they take people. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They take wealth. And so now you have Jehoiakim under Babylon, and you have Jewish people, educated people, the ones that the Babylonians wanted. And they're pressed into service in Babylon. This goes on for some time, and now we're down to about 598. And 598, Jehoiakim gets the great idea that he is going to stop sending tribute to Babylon. He's paid enough tribute. He's done paying tribute. He doesn't want any more of that. The Babylonians don't look kindly on this. So the Babylonians come and they lay siege to Jerusalem. Okay, and again, when Jerusalem is under siege, you can't get food in, you can't get trash out, so you have hunger, you have disease, and you have anarchy. People begin to questioning the leadership. And so you're ripe for being taken over. And do you know what King Jehoiakim does? He dies. He just dies. What a chicken way out of it. We don't know how he died. We don't know why he died. But the truth is, he died and he never had to face it. Just what a chicken way. So anyways, his son comes to the throne. And his name is Jehoiakim. Just remember, N comes after M. So you get Jehoiakim, who is king for 11 years, and makes a foolish decision of withholding tribute from Babylon. He's surrounded, and so he just dies. And his son, Jehoiakim, comes to the throne and gets to be king during the siege. And so after about 3 months, he surrenders. And he is taken prisoner to Babylon. And what the Babylonians do is they decide they're going to go ahead and still keep a vassal king there. And they place on the throne a guy by the name of Zedekiah. Zedekiah is still in the line of David. Okay, it's important to recognize that you still have a son of David on the throne ruling in Jerusalem. And that the temple is still functioning. They're still offering sacrifices. They're still, well, at least in form, they're still worshiping the Lord. Okay, and they're still in the promised land. And Zedekiah is going to be king all the way up until about 587. And Zedekiah is going to get tired of paying tribute to Babylon. He's going to be thinking that maybe Egypt will help him. Anyways, he rebels. And this time the Babylonians have had enough. And they come, they surround the city again, it's under siege again. And do you know what Zedekiah and his family does? They try to escape. And they escape and they're caught. And the Babylonians kind of set up court really quick. And they execute all the sons of Zedekiah in front of Zedekiah. And then they blind him, they gouge out his eyes, and then they take him captive to Babylon. will he be a prisoner till he dies. The last thing he saw, it's like the end of the kingdom. His son's put to death. Meanwhile, Jehoiakim, he's still in prison in Babylon. And so we had wave one of exile, about 605, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. We have wave two of exile, about 598, Jehoiakim. Oh, this is when Ezekiel was taken captive. And so Ezekiel, a young man preparing for the priesthood, taken captive at about age 25 to Babylon. And eventually God will call him to be a prophet while in Babylon. And then you have the final wave of exile, if you will, the wave, the tsunami that crashes everything, 587. And we have the full exile. Okay, are you tracking with me? I know I've given you a lot of information really fast, but I thought you might be curious how we got from chapter 39 to chapter 40, comfort, comfort my people. Now, we need to talk a little bit about their pain. You got to realize that when they were taken captive in 598, you know, Jehoiakim was taken to Babylon, Ezekiel taken to Babylon, you got to realize that they thought, okay, we're still covered by God's promises. Because you still had Zedekiah on the throne, son of David. And so remember, God had made David a promise that you won't, that you will always have a son on the throne, a dynasty, an everlasting kingdom. So it's kind of like, okay, we got a different son of David, but we still got a kingdom. We still got a throne of David. We're good. God's got us covered. Never mind how we're living, God's got us covered. And then the temple. We haven't talked a lot about this, but when Solomon dedicates the temple, Solomon makes this beautiful prayer. God, when we seek you here, will you hear from heaven and will you respond to our request? Would you heal us, forgive us, answer our prayers? And God says, yes. My name will be there. I will watch over that place. It's like my attention is there, and I'll respond. But it is a conditional promise. And God says, don't act like you're seeking me if you're not willing to listen to me. And so if you're not listening to me, you're not practicing the instructions I've given you, don't think that somehow this building is going to save you. Or that I'm going to save you just because this building has my name on it. But remember, 598, yeah, poor Jehoiakim, he's taken captive. But Zedekiah, the throne of David is intact, the temple is there, it's still standing. And they're still in the promised land. That land that God promised. So, I mean, they're in their minds, they're probably singing Standing on the Promises. Because they're still there. In fact, probably going into it more than we need to, but there are false prophets that are telling the people that were taken captive to Babylon, you know, Ezekiel and Jehoiakim and that group, hey, don't worry, you're not going to be there long. The God's got us covered. You'll be coming home soon. Well, this is where Jeremiah fits in. Jeremiah has not only been announcing that judgment is going to be coming on the temple and on the people for trusting in the temple, and everybody's kind of laughing at Jeremiah, look, the temple's still standing. Jeremiah also writes those captives that were taken, and he tells them, hey, settle down in Babylon. Pray for the peace of Babylon. Settle down, raise families, plant gardens. See your kids grow up and marry them off and see your grandkids. Oh, and I got good news for you. In 70 years, you'll be coming home. Where are you going in 70 years? So he's telling them, hey, don't listen to the false prophets. You're right where God has you. You're not coming home. But God's intentions are good. And you got to learn that. Well, anyways, back to Jerusalem. They're destroyed. People carried off into captivity. And with that comes all kinds of questions. Now, the easiest way for me to think about this is to think in terms of T's. Okay, so the first thing that they lost was the promised terrain. Promised land, promised tierra, promised tundra, but we'll go terrain. So the land that was promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the land that Moses said, when you enter into it, live this way, keep covenant, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself, and you'll experience God's blessings in that land. And the land that Joshua led them into, you know, and that they celebrated at Shechem, like we've been hearing about. And as for me and my house, we will serve the, that land that was promised to them by God belongs to Babylon. And they're no longer in it. And they're carried hundreds of miles away, captives in Babylon, a strange and foreign land. So they lost the what?
Terrain.
The terrain, the promised terrain. They also lost the promised throne. They didn't just lose a king, they lost the throne. And that throne had been promised by God to David, an everlasting dynasty. You'll never fail to have a son on the throne. And the throne is gone. And they lost the promised temple. Babylonians destroyed it. They plundered it, ransacked it, took whatever valuables they could, and then they just destroyed it. So they have lost three things that God had promised. The terrain, the throne, and the temple. And they're in captivity. How do you think they're feeling? I mean, they had to be asking some pretty intense God questions. Like, God, you promised. And so, the Babylonians are telling them, well, your God's weak. Look at our temples. Look at our structures. Look at our idols. Look at our wealth. Look at our victory. Look where you're at. Scoreboard. So you might as well give up on your God, because your God is weak and didn't save you, couldn't save you. You might as well join in and assimilate and worship our gods. Just kind of become Babylonian. Just melt right in with us. So that's one option, one question. Was our God too weak to save us? A second option is that our God wasn't too weak to save us. Our God abandoned us. Our God bailed out on us. Our God quit on us. And again, so they're wrestling with that question. You know, do we believe the Babylonians and say that our God was weak and we should worship the true God, the strong God, their gods? Or do we recognize that our God's really not worthy of our worship? It's not a matter of our God being weak. Our God just didn't keep his promises. Not faithful, abandoned, rejected. I mean, those are major God questions. And then you're wrestling with questions. Okay, well, what do we do? Do we try to maintain our identity? Do we try to maintain our distinctiveness? And we heard last night, if God's not with them, they have no distinctiveness. And so they're wrestling with all of these really intense God questions. Questions of abandonment, questions of our God too weak, questions of should we join? Do we try to stay faithful to this God? What do we do? And in the midst of this, Jeremiah is still at work. And God has raised up Ezekiel with a fresh word. And they still have the words of Isaiah. And we gather and kind of putting it all together at some level. What T did they still have? Torah. They still had God's instructions for how they were to live. They still had covenant, the Torah being the instructions for how to live in that covenant. And then sometime along the way, through the words of the prophets, the teachings of the prophets, through the work of the Holy Spirit, what they began to realize at some level is that God had not abandoned or bailed out on them, and that God was not too weak. Rather, what was God doing? God was being faithful to the covenant. Because if we took the time to look back through Deuteronomy, to look back into Leviticus, what we would see is that after all of the covenant stipulations are given, God lays out blessings and curses. And if you listen to me and how to go about life, then I'll make life a garden for you. You experience blessing, peace, abundance, joy. But if you decide to break covenant, no. If you decide to break Torah and not live faithful to how I'm instructing you, then you're going to come under curse. And the curses were things like famine and drought, sickness and plague, being invaded. But do you know what the ultimate curse was? Being expelled from the promised land. I can't resist. Adam and Eve come to mind. Expelled from the garden. And so you live and you keep covenant. You listen to how I instructed you. And life in the promised land is garden-esque. But if you decide that you're going to live a different way and worship other gods and take advantage of each other and exploit each other, then you're going to come under curse. And the ultimate curse is you will be expelled from the... Do you see what God was doing? God had not abandoned them. And God had not somehow been defeated by Babylon. Rather, God is actually at work using Babylon to execute the covenant curses. So what does that mean about God? God was being faithful to the covenant. Do you see any hope in that? Yeah. Because if God is faithful enough to execute the curses of the covenant, somewhere along the line it began to dawn on them that maybe if they start living faithful to God in Babylon, God will be faithful to keep the blessings of the covenant. And so the people began to find a way through their grief under the leadership of the prophets, inspired by the Holy Spirit, thinking back over their history in terms of Joshua and Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. They began to realize, wow, this is how God works, that God is always faithful. And that God keeps the covenant. And when we're breaking covenant or when we're living against Torah, God is faithful to execute curses. But when we humble ourselves and repent and turn back to God, God has never abandoned us. God's still in covenant. And God will be faithful to keep the covenant, to bless. So we think where chapter 40 comes in. We're probably somewhere around 545-ish BC. Jerusalem fell 587. I think Jehoiakim was released from prison about 561. That's another story. But we're kind of coming to the end of kind of the official window of exile. Cyrus is coming to power in 539. And in the midst of this, God says, through Isaiah, speaking, into this future, into these generations of exiles, dealing with all these questions, comfort, comfort who? My people. Did God abandon them? still claiming them. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. I don't know what to do with that double. Like, I don't know whether it you know, some people would say that God overpaid them back for their sins. Some people would take that in terms of not only this generation, but the next generation. So kind of a doubling of the generations. My best way of understanding it, it's just an emphatic way of saying paid in full. That they have received the curse in full in terms of the terms of the covenant. A voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. See, God is coming. It's not just make a way for you to go back to Jerusalem. It's like God is the one who is returning. And that was one of the visions that Ezekiel had, was God departing from the temple. And so we see God's intent. And look with me at verse 5. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh together will see it. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? All flesh, all men are like grass. And all their glory is like the flowers of the field. And this word glory, it's a little bit different word than the word glory that we heard last night, even though it's translated here as glory. This word glory here could also be translated as loyalty, as steadfast love. So it's a little bit different than the glory word, and that's kind of one of the problems with English, is that the Hebrew words can be very heavy and have nuances, and our translators struggle to figure out which best captures the intent or the weight of the word. And so, but think about it this way. All men are like grass, and their loyalty is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. Who did Ahaz trust? Assyria. He was impressed with the glory of Assyria. Thought that they would be steadfast and loyal. Who was Hezekiah trying to impress? Babylon, like their glory was going to last forever. Let me try to impress them. Surely they'll be able to sustain my kingdom. But it's the word of our God that stands forever. Whose loyalty are you going to trust in? You bring good tidings to Zion. Go up on a high mountain. You bring good tidings to Jerusalem. Lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. God is coming as a shepherd king. That the people have dealt with their sin. Maybe they finally said, whoa, I'm not sure. But they're at this point where God is coming as the shepherd king to regather them and to gently lead them home. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breath of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on a scale and the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord? Who has measured the spirit of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? And who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Do you catch what's going on here? Why would you ever worship the gods of Babylon? The Lord is the one who will save you. The Lord is the one who is the creator of the heavens and the earth. The Lord is the one whose understanding is beyond measure. Don't be deceived into joining the Babylonians. Verse 15, surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. So what Isaiah is calling attention to, as they're dealing with their questions And like, can God really comfort us? Can God really restore us as a shepherd king? Calling attention to number one, our God is the creator. The nations. Don't think the nations are going to save you. The nations are like a drop in a bucket. The nations are dust in the scales. The nations are nothing compared to our God, the Creator. Look at verse 18. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. So who are you going to compare God to? Are you seriously thinking about comparing God to an idol? An idol has to be propped up. It can be decorated. It can be made to look really shiny. But the bottom line is, you better take care of that idol or it will topple. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. The Creator God. Man, we had Creator, we had look at the nations. You gonna compare him to an idol? He's the Creator. Now look again. He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. Its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy, spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. Do you see the parallel? Now we're back to nations. So I had Creator, nations. Who are you gonna compare me to? An idol? Now we go back, he's the creator, he's above, and then we talk about that he brings the princes to naught, the rulers of the world to nothing. Why go with the nations? No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me? See the parallel with verse 18? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry hosts one by one, calls them each by name because of his great power and mighty strength. Not one of them is missing. And again, I can just see it. Who are you going to compare me to? An idol? Now what? You're going to compare me to a star? He's over it all. He's the creator. He names the stars, has power over the stars, keeps track of the stars. Verse 27. Maybe the key line in terms of catching what this is all about. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? My cause is disregarded by my God. They're hearing this good news, but they can't hear this good news. After God seemingly not keeping promises. After being in Babylon and seeing their wealth and prosperity and the temples to their gods and their economy, hearing this good news of comfort and that you're going home is pretty hard to hear. And it's kind of like, God, do you really know what you've put us through? Do you really understand where we're at? Why do you say? Why do you complain? Isaiah says, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary. Young men stumble and fall. But what? Those who hope in the Lord, those who wait on the Lord, will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Do you hear what Isaiah is calling them to generations later in the midst of their confusions and questions and feeling like God doesn't know and God's abandoned and God's forsaken? He's calling them to trust that God has good for you. And that those who wait upon the Lord, they're going to discover that their strength is renewed. And he's going to enable them to soar. Whatever it is that they need to soar over, whatever it is that's kind of down there that they need to get over, he will enable them to soar over it. Whether it's the stuff in Babylon, whether it's stuff that they're trying to get rid of, whether it's soar. He will renew your strength. When I think soaring, I think of getting over something. But he'll also enable you to run and not grow weary. And when I think about running, I think about getting tired. But when I think about running, typically running, you've got something you're trying to get through. You know, Vonda always points out to us that we can kind of handle anything for a month or 2 months. You know, we'll get through it. I think of, you know, I've seen John Mark do a marathon. I've seen John Mark do various contests, Spartan race. There's always a finish line. And you run to the finish line. You get through whatever the obstacle is. They that wait upon the Lord, he'll renew your strength. You will make it to whatever finish line it is that you got to get through, that you got to get to. And then he'll renew the strength of those who are walking, and they won't faint. You know, and sometimes you just got to keep walking. You can't see a finish line. You don't have a finish line out there. And it's nothing that you can just soar over. That sometimes there's just stuff that we got to walk in and walk through. But you know what? You're not abandoned. That as we place our hope, our trust, as we wait upon the Lord, what we discover is that our strength is renewed. And whatever we got to walk through, we won't faint. He'll keep us walking. And when we're trying to get through those times in life where there's a finish line out there and it's a tough course with a lot of obstacles and maybe some mountains, we'll run and not grow weary. We'll get to the finish line. And those things that we just got to get over, he'll give us the wings to do it and the wind to do it under those wings. And so why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. I don't know what you might be dealing with this morning that leaves you in a place where you feel like, I don't know if God knows. I don't know if God really sees. I mean, we've been hearing about that, but you know, when you're in a place, it can be hard to actually hear good news because the reality of the pain is so great that it affects your hearing. And, you know, we're talking about having a healing time here, and I know I need to hurry so that we can have time for healing, but I just wonder. Sometimes we're at a place where what we need healing from is just so loud and so painful that we can't hear the good news that there is healing. And that there is strength for the journey. Whether it's something that we need to soar over, whether it's something that we need to run through to a finish line, or whether it's just something that we're going to have to walk. But he's going to give us strength that we don't faint. And he is our healer. He is the one who strengthens us. He is the one who renews us. And so it might be total cure. I mean, soaring over it. It might be strength to walk without fainting. But I assure you, he knows. And so listen to these words once more. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, not temporary. The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary. He increases the power of the weak. Even youths may grow tired and weary, and young men may stumble and fall badly. But those who hope in the Lord, those who wait upon the Lord, will renew their strength. And they will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And I simply invite you to wait upon the Lord this morning and to open yourself to the strength that he wants to give you. Whether that's strength and healing, so that you simply begin to soar over whatever that ailment, that injury, that hurt has been. Whether it's making it through something, whether it's walking without fainting. But as we place our hope in him, we have the assurance that he knows and he will give us the exact strength that we need. Pastor Rob.
We come to this time with all the joys and the burdens of life, the scars and the stories of our journeys. And we have been invited by God himself to come before him. James instructs us that when there are sick among you, that you should bring them. Bring them to the elders and anoint them with oil and pray. And ask for God's touch. And so that's what we want to do this morning. Some of our elders who have bottles of oil, if you would just take your places now, some across the front, some around, wherever it may be, so that there will be people that you can pray with.